Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The recently leaked majority draft opinion by Justice Samuel Alito in the Mississippi abortion case seemed to hold the promise to fulfill the work carried on for decades by an amalgam of conservative political operatives and a cross-section of deeply conservative religious leaders. Together, they have been working steadily to reshape the federal judiciary, a judiciary today that has fundamentally transformed Establishment Clause religious issues into free speech issues on religion, and that has transformed the Republican Party from a party of commerce and Main Street business to a regressive cultural party obsessed with fundamentalist Christian issues. My guest today has reported on that intersection of political, religious, and moneyed interests that have at their heart holding political power as a goal. Catherine Stewart is an investigative journalist who's written for The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Atlantic, and many other publications. Her previous book, The Good News Club, examined the religious right's efforts to co-opt and undermine public education. Her most recent book examines the network of think tanks, advocacy groups, and pastoral organizations in alliance to gain power and control all levers of government. Her book, The Power Worshippers, is now out in a new edition and also documents the changes in the federal judiciary and the political revisionism that undermines the longstanding separation of church and state, which is central to the foundation of this alliance. Catherine Stewart is my guest today. Catherine Stewart, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me to the conversation.
You know, it's been several weeks now since Justice Alito's draft majority opinion has leaked. And of course, there's been nonstop conversation about what that exactly means. Is this likely to be the majority opinion? Was it an early draft that's still looking for five justices to sign on to? But I'm more interested in the movement that you write about in The Power Worshippers that has used abortion as sort of like the central springboard towards political power. If Roe is overruled, what will this mean for that political movement that you document?
Well, the political movement is not going away. In fact, when you go to their conferences and listen to their overarching strategy with regards to abortion, they think they're just getting started. I attended this year's National Pro-Life Summit in Washington, D.C. in January, where the leading activists and strategists and affiliated politicians were gathering to sort of discuss what they were expecting in terms of abortion policy this year and beyond. And Kristen Hawkins, who is the president of Students for Life of America, one of the leading anti-abortion organizations, she said, let me tell you what the plan is. I'm paraphrasing here. She says, our plan is to introduce we're going to take it to the states. We're not going to stop there. We'd like to introduce a constitutional amendment banning abortion nationwide, but that's going to take some time to set up. And I spoke with a representative of the Alliance Defending Freedom, what's one of the legal advocacy organizations of the religious right. And he said pretty much the same thing. So what we're really seeing today is the consequences of decades of planning by religious right legal strategists to stack the courts with ideologues. The leaked draft opinion, Alito's leaked draft opinion, you know, may have come as a surprise to many Americans, but for those who have been watching this movement, it was pretty predictable and a sign of the pact between the Republican Party and America's religious nationalists.
Now, if that is the goal, you know, one question I have is that when you look at national polling, this is not a majority popular view. Other issues that they're tackling, most of them are not majority popular views. While you may have the courts acquiescent, you still have to have the legislative branch. Is that a worry for, say, pro-life legislators or the Republican Party itself that has cozied itself up to this movement?
You know, this is a movement that realized a long time ago, you don't need a majority of the population to win elections. All you need is a disproportionately organized and activated minority. And for years, abortion has been, you know, if you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote. So they've devoted all of these resources to persuading a significant minority of the population that abortion is the dividing line between insiders and outsiders, the pure and the impure. Now, if they say, you know, they may not seem to be worried about that, within in the conferences that I attend, the sort of right-wing strategy gatherings and summits and conferences. But frankly, they should be. And this is a minority opinion. As you said, most Americans approve of some form of abortion rights and abortion access. In Oklahoma right now, you have a ban on abortion after 6 weeks. Look, I'm a mother. I've got two kids and I've had several miscarriages. I never knew I was pregnant at 6 weeks. I mean, that's before many women even know that they're pregnant. And I think many people think, well, I'd never have an abortion. That doesn't relate to me. But they don't recognize that these very strict bans on abortion are going to reach very deep into maternal medicine and affect maternal health care for large, large numbers of women, perhaps even a majority of American women. So this is likely to, you know, it's already inspiring enormous unhappiness and dissatisfaction among many members of the population. And, you know, but this is also a movement that doesn't frankly believe in representative democracy. You know, they want to, you know, have disproportionate influence in the votes, not just by turning out their folks in disproportionate numbers, but through gerrymandering, often race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression, where votes that they don't like don't get counted properly. Ralph Reed, who's one of the leading and I think very astute longtime strategists of the movement, he calls it the Republican reapportionment advantage. He says, you know, if Democrats are up 1 to 3 points, we win. He said it sort of with a smile on his face. And he said, if they're up 4 to 7 points, then it's a jump ball. And if they're up 8 points or more, that's when they win. But it really shows how all of this strategy on their part has degraded voting rights, the sort of principles, you know, the voting rights, which are assured by our Constitution. And then, of course, you have others promoting the lie of stolen elections. They think if an election doesn't go the way they want, they just say that it was stolen. And that sets the stage for another insurrection or worse.
Yeah. Well, you write about the birth of Christian nationalism in the Power Worshippers, and it really does come from this political basis. You know, it's often said that it sprung out of the Roe decision, but as you write, this was more of an outgrowth of the political movement that started with Nixon's Southern strategy in reaction to civil rights. And as that went on, they saw, well, yes, it might work in the South, but it won't work as a national strategy. And they were looking for an issue that would, a moral issue, if you will, that would galvanize conservative voters. And abortion became that moral issue to galvanize them.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great issue for them because it united conservative Protestants and conservative Catholics, and even brought in, as one of the leaders of the new right said, some of our fringe fundamentalist friends, you know. But here's the thing. At the time that Roe v. Wade passed in 1973, most Protestant Republicans supported it. The Southern Baptist Convention passed resolutions in 1971 and 1974 affirming support for liberalized abortion laws in Roe v. Wade. And let's not forget, Betty Ford called Roe v. Wade a great, great decision. Barry Goldwater, that great conservative hero, supported abortion rights, at least early in his career. And his wife, Peggy, co-founded Planned Parenthood in Arizona, if you can believe that. You know, it was said to, you know, some form of abortion access was said to accord well with, you know, middle-class Protestant values of, you know, just all the values that they sort of espoused at that time. But it's over time that these right-wing activists that called themselves the new right, they felt the Republican Party had become too soft on communism. They were really worried about the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, but they needed an attractive issue they could use to unite their movement and these different factions, and also bring in the sort of what they call the electronic ministers. They knew they needed to get religion because they felt American religion under the influence of people like Paul Tillich and Niebuhr had become too liberal. Protestantism, they felt, was becoming too liberal. They wanted to sort of drag the country in a sort of reactionary, into this reactionary place, and they needed an issue they could use, and they settled on abortion. And over time, they purged pro-choice voices from the Republican Party, actually took a tremendous amount of work. And Phyllis Schlafly wrote a really terrific book about that. It's called How the Republican Party Became Pro-Life. See, it wasn't pro-life. It wasn't anti-abortion. It became anti-abortion thanks to activists like her and others who shunned the sort of prior consensus around, or loose consensus around, abortion rights liberalization. And over time, they sort of established abortion as the issue that they could use to garner votes and unite sort of Protestants and Catholics, which was quite a thing at the time. And so today we're seeing a kind of like pro-life religion, but it's like, it's a modern creation and it was created for political purposes.
My guest today is Catherine Stewart. She's a journalist who writes about politics, policy, and religion. Her previous book is titled The Good News Club on the Religious Right and Public Education. Her latest book is out in a new edition, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. And in the book, you sort of combine telling big picture stories as well as sort of micro level stories. For example, in the lead up to the 2018 election, you go to a gathering in a little town called Unionville, right along the North Carolina, South Carolina border. And, you know, Tony Perkins there from his group is there, and you sort of infiltrate these gatherings. What did you learn from that experience?
Oh, that was a really interesting experience. I wouldn't call it infiltrating. I attended with a friend of mine who was a pastor. I was his guest. He is his church is a member of Southern Baptist Convention and also another sort of more moderate Baptist organization. And, you know, it was an event for pastors. Dozens of pastors were in attendance. And leaders of the movement like Tony Perkins and Jerry Boykin and so many others, they were there to give these pastors the talking points they need to turn out the congregations to vote their so-called biblical values, which inevitably, and you know, for them, boil down to, you know, abortion, anti, you know, same-sex marriage stuff and the like. They know if you can get the pastors, you can get their congregations. So they're there telling us, you know, that abortion is the, you know, most vital and important issue of our time. There are multiple speakers. Somebody up there gave a sort of disclaimer and said, you know, this is a nonpartisan gathering. You know, there is no, you know, we don't support any particular candidate or political party. But once the action started, it was a full day event, including lunch. It was absolutely clear. There was no possible confusion about which way pastors were supposed to get their congregations to vote for their so-called biblical values. They distributed all kinds of materials to these pastors, voter guides. There were like, must have been tens of thousands of them in the room. And they were telling pastors to take as many as they could. And pastors were filling up their cars to give to members of their congregations and also to their other pastors. And then they gave them sermon starters, you know, and videos they could air at church. So they give them these tremendous tools to turn out their congregations to vote a certain way. And this was an initiative that was sponsored by the Family Research Council. It's one of the leading policy groups of the religious right or the religious nationalist movement. And it's an initiative called Watchmen on the Wall. This is an organization that claims to have tens of thousands of affiliated pastors around the country. And there are other initiatives like it. Faith Wins is one, Church United is another. There are quite a few of these very, frankly, they're political. You know, they'll say that they're not, but they are, because they're trying to get people to vote their so-called biblical values. And I've attended a number of these events. I've attended a Faith Wins event, a Church United event. And at these events, sometimes they will actually talk about, you know, the Democratic Party as, you know, ruled by darkness. I mean, Tony Perkins at this event, you know, quoted from Ephesians and said, you know, we fight, you know, not, you know, powers and principalities and all that. And, you know, rulers of the darkness. And it was clear the way he was thinking. He was trying to sort of bring people to think that, you know, the Democratic Party or progressive or liberal, what have you, policies are actually, you know, on the side of the quote unquote darkness. And so I mean, this is something that you hear at a lot of these gatherings. They cast themselves as engaged in a struggle between absolute good and absolute evil. I've heard, you know, Democratic Party initiative described as demonic. I mean, this is a lot of very dehumanizing language. And this is very, very dangerous. People with different politics or different political opinions, you know, in these sort of far right religious nationalist spaces are not being cast as, you know, your neighbors who just have a difference of opinion and you might not agree with them and maybe you should try to persuade them. They're being cast as, you know, as subhuman, as demonic, and as, you know, satanic. And, you know, I was listening the other day, this might seem like a non sequitur, but I was listening to the sort of Fox News of Russia. It's like Russia State TV, and one of their very popular spokespeople was talking to about the Ukraine war. He said, Ukrainians, they are little devils. They are demonic. He said, they are godless. And you good Orthodox Christian soldiers, you need to finish them off. I mean, this is the language of genocide. We've seen the consequences of this kind of incredibly dehumanizing language over and over throughout history. It has preceded some of the most disgraceful and disgusting episodes in our history. And when you think about January 6th and you think about what happened that day, the violence, the incredible chaos and the attack on the foundations of our democracy, frankly, this kind of rhetoric is where it comes from.
Earlier, you said, you know, there was this standard disclaimer about, you know, this is a nonpartisan event. It made me think, you know, do any of these organizations or these pastors, do they still fear the Johnson Amendment, which, you know, says if you're advocating as a nonprofit advocating for a political party or a political point of view, you can lose your tax-exempt status. Is there any fear from these organizations about that today?
Not in the least. I mean, the last time there was a real examination of this kind of thing was led by a Republican. It was like an investigative committee led by Charles Grassley, who's a Republican. It was a Republican-led investigation. They were looking into people like Paul White and Creflo Dollar and about six other, maybe five other pastors who were, you know, owned multiple homes, airplanes, airplane leasing companies, all of which are tax exempt, Chuck Colson. And, you know, we're talking like multiple millions of dollars, just, you know, vast wealth. And Chuck Grassley was looking at these folks and saying, wait a second, why are we giving these people these tax exemptions? And they were, there was such an outcry. They called this like an incredible violation of religious freedom. And, you know, they said their rights were being trampled. And he pulled back and he said, okay, these folks really have to self-police. And that was more into the financial side of it. But on the political side, anytime there's any, so the IRS sort of looks askance, there is such hue and cry that, you know, the claims of religious persecution, et cetera, et cetera. Some of the very political pastors in this movement, I think it's, I can't recall his name right now. He's actually written political sermons and he sends them to the IRS, you know, goading them into doing something. I wrote about that in my book, but I just can't think off the top of my head which pastor it is. And, you know, other pastors are engaged in this initiative called Pulpit Freedom Sunday, where they deliver explicitly political messaging. And the IRS does not dare take a stance because of the complaints about, oh, you're persecuting us. So the religious right, you know, they want to have it both ways. They want their cake and they eat it too. They want to claim they're just speech like everybody else when they want to get into the public schools and talk about politics, et cetera. But boy, are they going to defend their tax privilege? They want, oh no, we're not like everybody else. We're very special. So, you know, they enjoy tax privileges that non-religious nonprofits don't enjoy. They don't parson exemptions, which in some instances means multiple houses, airplanes, boats, et cetera. And then they also don't have to open their books to the IRS. Most non-religious nonprofits, you know, to justify their tax exemption, they have to file their tax forms with the IRS so everybody can see how the money is being spent. Oh, you want your tax exemption? Great. Well, let's have some accountability and transparency here. Religions don't have to do that. So they are really trying to have their cake and eat it, Tim.
My guest today is Catherine Stewart. Her latest book is The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. It's out in a new edition. One of the things that's really interesting, you write about David Barton, who's a part of this movement, who is sort of the historian, if you will, a revisionist historian that documents this movement. Talk about David Barton's role in sort of revising early history of America to make it this Christian nation. You really say it comes really out of the Engel versus Vital rooting, the decision ending prayer in school.
Yeah, you know what? David Barton is indispensable to this movement because he tells the movement leaders the stories that they need to hear in order to change the charter of our country. They want to take it back to a time that never was. In Barton's telling, our founders were all, you know, Bible-thumping fundamentalists who all want to establish a Christian nation. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. The founders were a fairly heterodox group, but a number of them were actually deists, which were considered religious heretics in their time. They believed in a kind of what one would call God of nature. It's more of a pantheist idea of God. In fact, Jefferson actually sort of, you know, did some surgery on the Bible and came up with Jefferson's Bible. They really took, one thing they really wanted to do was establish separation of religion and government in our Constitution. And if you go back and look at some of the readings of people like Jefferson and Madison, they really wanted to establish separation of church and state. But the facts are very inconvenient to the religious right. They claim to be patriots, but they can't do that if they are violating the spirit, if not the letter of the Constitution. So they have to rewrite our history. And David Barton does that. He also moonlights as a Republican Party sort of activist and strategist and has served a number of different roles. He's headed up a number of legislative initiatives, education initiatives. I call him actually the Where's Waldo of the Christian nationalist movement. If you have kids, you know what Where's Waldo is. It's a children's book where you see like large groups of faces and you know, ask, where's Waldo? There he is. And David Barton's kind of like that. He shows up everywhere. But he's gotten in a lot of trouble, even with his own book publisher. His Christian book publisher, Thomas Nelson Publishing, had to cease publication and withdraw one of his books because it was said to contain so many factual errors. It was the first time in the history of the publishing house that they'd ever had to do that. But that doesn't seem to have slowed Barton down.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the book, you profile these people that are sort of underneath the radar for most Americans. Leonard Leo from the Federalist Society that has helped change the nature of the federal judiciary. And in our last moment, I want to talk a little about the Supreme Court. You know, in the 80s, you saw the emergence of a new legal strategy against that establishment clause that you write about. You know, the state can't support or establish religion or religious practice. Instead of supporting religious activities under the free exercise of religion, which was usually the sort of the balancing act that justices were asked to consider, you know, are you doing your own religion or are you establishing it on behalf of others, on behalf of the state? These lawsuits were brought on the idea that it challenged on free speech grounds. Now, in the 80s and 90s, most of those arguments were rejected, but it seems like in the last 20 years, that has completely changed.
That's right. That was a novel legal. I think the legal activist organizations to an underappreciated degree are leading the strategy of the movement overall. And, you know, let's not forget that Leonard Leo realized that he would never, the society, people, not enough people would agree with what he wanted to do with our society. So he knew he needed to change the courts. He said at one point, I would like to see the courts unrecognizable. And then he said, you know, Trump is the change we've been waiting for. So he really knew that by stacking the courts and bringing novel legal building blocks to the right courts that would be favorable to these novel legal concepts, you could over time achieve a really big win that was going to degrade the separation of church and state. And that's what they did. So they was through the 80s and 90s, you know, a lot of people were not really focused on the religious right. A lot of people thought it was sort of on the wane. They saw it as fringe. People made fun of it. You know, they made fun of what they called fundamentalism. And they didn't recognize the fact that, you know, this is a movement that has invested in strategy for decades. And they've also known that they can get a lot done if they're under the radar. I think we underestimate and have underestimated the strength of this movement at our peril.
Well, you know, as everyone is awaiting the Roe versus Wade decision, we have an idea that at the least there will be probably more restrictions on abortion, whether Roe is completely overruled. That's still an open question at this point. What do you think is next for this movement? Will it be trying to, obviously, about half the states have major restrictions on abortion if Roe is overturned. What do you think the next steps for this the organizations are?
Well, you know, the draft opinion overturning Roe insists that only those rights specifically enumerated in the Constitution deserve judicial protection. And when the, you know, they this is what they say, but you know, they have no trouble. So you know, I think a lot of rights that are not enumerated in the Constitution specifically. The right to same-sex marriage, the right to contraception, all kinds of rights to privacy are on the chopping block. But of course, the court doesn't have the slightest trouble in claiming some transparently unenumerated rights when it serves the interests of the group they favor. So the court has determined that parents somehow have the right to draw on public funds for the education of their children in religious schools. This is not a right enumerated in the Constitution, but somehow they found constitutional justification for it. The Second Amendment nowhere enumerates the right to own a semi-automatic weapon or an unregistered handgun. Yet this court, of course, has determined that such a constitutional right, in fact, exists. So really, this is a movement that's determined to seek privileges for groups that they favor and policies that they favor, and yet the right to deprive groups that they don't approve of or policies that they don't approve of. You know, deprive people of their rights in certain instances. It's really a way of establishing a kind of hierarchy, you know, of privilege in our society. And that's really not what, that's not what America's about. You know, the principles of equality and pluralism represent the best of the American promise, and they're worth defending.
Let me ask you about other decisions that sort of follow in the Roe footsteps, the sort of right of privacy, the right of, you know, so when you look at other things that come out of that, going all the way back to Griswold versus Connecticut, which is a contraceptive case, or Loving versus Virginia, which is a interracial marriage case, or more recent, like Obergefell versus Hodges, the gay marriage case. Do you think those are in jeopardy if Roe is overturned?
I think it's possible. I can't see into the future. But one thing that the right-wing justices have signaled very clearly is, you know, they keep repeating history and tradition. But when they talk about history and tradition, they're really signaling a certain kind of a history. I think it's a history, the kind of history and tradition that they want. It's a tradition that's emphatically, if implicitly understood as a certain kind of conservative Christian tradition, or as they sometimes characterize it, Judeo-Christian.
The name of the book is The Power Worshippers. Catherine Stewart, thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Catherine Stewart is an investigative journalist who writes about the intersection of politics, policy, and religion. Her latest book, The Power Worshippers: Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism, is now out in a new edition. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.